welcome to this week's limited edition extended remixed version of Otherwhere, our weekly detour to that which activates, enhances or evolves our multidimensional inner spiritual technologies. This is a program about the magic, mysteries and miracles of life and how to find ways to help us transcend the limitations of being locked into a five-sense reality. This week, we continue this exceptional journey with someone who will offer you much to ponder on about life and indeed death, the biggest question any of us will ever have to face and ultimately ever come to understand. What happens when our physical body and the spark that animates it part forever? What happens to us when we die? And what lies beyond? That, along with quite a few more of life's other biggest questions, serve as the focus of our fascinating dialogue with our guest, artist, inventor, and near-death experiencer, Mellon Thomas Benedict, a man who may just have the answers, a man who, after dying of terminal cancer in 1982, journeyed to the light and miraculously came back with an account of the afterlife that is unparalleled in our history. Since his experience, he has retained the ability to go back to the light at will, and because of this, he has also been able to bring back scientific discoveries and now holds several US patents on new healing technologies. You will never hear another show like this, or another guest like Mellon Thomas Benedict. So relax, make yourself very comfortable, and get ready, because this is one show you do not want to miss a minute of. And I must extend a very warm welcome to all the new listeners. I sense that there are more of you out there than usual, so thank you for tuning in, and especially so if you're hearing this live. You're part of a very special family that we have dubbed the Otherwhere Circle of Lights, made up by all of your shining hearts as you listen in all of the world's different time zones. It means a lot to me that you're out there, as I know it's very early in the morning in some parts of the world and some listeners have either stayed up late or set your alarm so you could join us. Thank you to you and everybody else listening in for adding your beautiful energy to this broadcast, no matter when you're hearing this. And if somehow that ends up being sometime in the 24th century and you're cruising around in a big old starship, or if perchance you're on one now, just know I haven't left you guys out either, and I adore the fact that you're with us. Coming up later in the show, we'll learn that we are now only steps away from creating organic computers. Yes, that process information like a brain. I'll tell you exactly how much green tea a day you need to be drinking to stop the onset of memory loss and even Alzheimer's, and whether or not you should be wary of cosmetics or other personal products made with nanoparticles. We'll also hear about a new female android that Korean scientists have developed for department stores and museums. But first, let's have a listen to some music. And this is something that I think is very aptly titled for the show that we're just about to begin. It's from Mood to Swing, a production outfit who are a duo, Lem Springsteen and John Ciafone, who hail from New York City and who've been releasing quality tracks for at least the last 10 years. They're a favourite of mine, and this one, a recent release on King Street Sounds from late last year, features the smooth vocals of Lauren on a track that just can't help but make you feel good. It's called Magical Love.
Oh,
moodtosounds.com. That's a release by Mood to Swing featuring Lauren, entitled Magical Life. Now, as some of you know, I had to take last week off, and you got to hear a rebroadcast of the interview with Mary Rodwell about Star Kids and ET Contact. And while I've been off the air, the Post, I have to say, has been very kind. I took last week off because I've actually found out that I've developed some tendonitis in my right arm, due primarily to all of the frantic mouse manoeuvring I now have to do in order to produce this show. Now, I don't mind that very much, and luckily for me, I've got some pretty good tricks up my sleeve, so it hasn't really been too much of a problem, especially now that I've had a rest. But I got some lovely email that I'd like to read out. And the first one is from Syme, who is part of the Otherwear Network at Yahoo Groups. He says, "Don't bend the elbow too much while you're resting up. You take care of so much. Take care of yourself. We need you for the long haul." Syme, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And I promise that for as long as bbsradio.com wants me and my arm lets me, I will be here. I promise I'll be here for the long haul. I've also received some very wonderful feedback in support of the show, for which I'm very grateful. The first one is about Janosz, who we had on the show a few weeks ago. He's the graphic artist from Holland, who makes the amazing holograms of light that you can see at the website thearcturians.com, and that's with a hyphen in between the and Arcturians. John from Hawaii says, "Once again, love your show. I think what you're doing is a great thing for the greater good." I really appreciate that. Thank you. "The drawings by Janosz are extremely powerful. The first time I looked at one, it literally burned my eyeballs with its power. At work, I loaded one of his free downloads as wallpaper, and just about everyone that stops by to talk stares at it for a few seconds, mesmerized. Like I said, very powerful. Well, keep on doing what you're doing, as," and this is my favourite line in the email, "you could be doing a lot worse." John in Hawaii. Well, John, thank you. And I took your advice and went to the Arcturians.com website and downloaded some of that wallpaper for myself. And now I'm the one who's mesmerised. But it's a pretty wonderful thing if you've been to the activations like I have. Each time you look at those holograms again, it's like a whole new world opens up for you. So if you haven't seen them yourself, make sure you get along to thearcturians.com. And this one, which really blew me away, came in response to last week's show with Mary Rodwell and the subject of Star Kids and ET Contact. "Thank you so much for your work, your contribution, and going there. I greatly feel and intuit that you don't sugarcoat the issues like most other speakers we listen to, read, or are still holding the old energy paradigm. In email, this is hardly expressed appropriately. Anyway, my intention is to support you wholeheartedly and tell you how much I appreciate the work, your service, dedication, and how much we need you here at this time. Thank you. Big love and blessings, Lisa." Well, what can I say? Last week's show was really important to me. The subject is very close to my heart, and it's wonderful to know that there are people like yourself who are out there who appreciate these deep subjects that I'm delving into on this show. It's with your support that I know I'm on the right track. And speaking of being on the right track, if your response to this week's guest is any indication, then I must be doing some things right. Good for you, Liz, for getting Mel and Thomas as a guest. What a fascinating show this will be. I know that we can't wait and we'll be glued to the PC with all ears. You rock, girl. Love and light, Joshua. And from Michael in The Hague, he says, "Dear Liz, thank you for drawing attention to the story of Mel and Thomas Benedict. It confirms everything I believe in, have seen, read and experienced up till now. And I've drawn my friends and directed my light family's attention to it." when that email arrived, it echoed all of my sentiments exactly. Thank you so much to all of you who've written in. It's my pleasure to present this show. As you probably know, BBS Radio is community radio, which means that every single one of the presenters and all of the people who do all of the work behind the scenes do the work as a service to others endeavour. So please continue to send in your feedback, as it really is what inspires all of us to keep going. If you'd like to send me some feedback, or if you have a story to share, or if you'd like to just give me some constructive criticism, I'm open to all of it, and you can reach me at lizmusic.iprimus.com.au, and that's spelled lizmusic, one word, L-I-Z-M-U-Z-I-K, at iprimus.com.au. So that's lizmusic@iprimus.com.au. But if you didn't catch that, it's really easy to find my email address either at my blog. You can look up my profile and it'll be there. That's at www.otherwhere.blogspot.com. And of course, you can go to the bbsradio.com website, and that is at bbsradio.com. Click on the link to Otherwhere. Now, if you'd like a quick update on the old arm, it's still a little bit sore, I've got to admit. However, it's doing pretty well, considering that the doctor told me I've got a bad case of tendinitis and it could take up to 6 months to a year to heal. I, being the type of person that I am, wasn't really ready to accept that diagnosis, and I've been very busy in the time that I've been off the air for the last week, doing everything I can to make sure that it gets better, as this is the arm that helps me produce this show, so it's important. So I've been rubbing an ancient Aboriginal remedy into my arm. It's actually emu oil, which there is an abundance of down here, I can promise you. It's also been helped by the use of certain crystals. I've also been doing special stretches that my chiropractor showed me, and I've been using the healing codes, which is something that I've mentioned on the show before, but not for quite some time. And I thought I would definitely mention it again today, because this has actually helped so much. It's a cutting-edge energetic healing technique that I've been working with for the last couple of years, and I can truly say that it's created miracles not only in my life, but in the lives of those closest to me. And this isn't a sponsorship announcement. This is a true testimonial from someone who really has benefited from their product. If you'd like to know more, especially if this is going to help something that maybe you've been trying to find help for but haven't so far as yet found, then go to my blog. Once again, that's otherwhere.blogspot.com, and input healing codes into my search engine, and I can assure you, you're going to find quite a number of posts where I've described my experiences with it, as well as links to their website. But you can go to them right now if you want to at thehealingcodes.com, and I highly recommend looking at their testimonials and listening to some of the audios that are up there, because if they can help you as much as they have helped me, then I know that sending you there will be worth it. On the line. And now, here's some news you can use from the Otherwhere department. In a story from Discovery News, we find out that a rat nerve cell attached to a semiconductor chip has exchanged a signal with it, an achievement that could lead to organic computers that process information like a brain. And in the long term, the technology could also lead to prosthetic limbs that are controlled by a person's brain and nerves. The research is being done at the Max Planck Institute for Biochemistry in Germany, and the chip is called the NaChip, after Na for sodium, which also involves researchers from the University of Padua, Italy, and the University of Zurich in Switzerland. To make the nerve cell and the chip compatible, the researchers worked with German microchip company Infineon to modify the chip's surface, and the resulting 1mm chip has more than 16,000 transistors that match up with ion-carrying channels in the nerve cell. The chips were specially coated so that they could be immersed in a solution meant to keep the nerve cell alive. Next, the scientists used a protein called fibronectin to keep the nerve cell adhered to the silicon chip. Then the team monitored charged particles of sodium, the Na in NaChip, moving between the nerve and the transistor. They were able to stimulate the nerve cell by sending an electrical pulse from the chip's capacitors. Eventually, the NaChip team plans to move beyond the single rat cell to the rat brain. According to Fromhertz, the director of the project, scientists have all of the tools to couple hundreds of neurons to a semiconductor chip and conceivably perform simple computations. Shortly after I found that story, I found this one. South Korea creates female android. So can you kind of make the connection between the rat to the brain to the android to the... Yeah. Okay. South Korean scientists say they have created the world's second android, a female named Eve R-1. The android can understand about 400 words, speak, blink her eyes, and display several facial expressions, and this was reported in the Korea Times on Thursday. Japan developed the first android in 2003, but scientists from the Korea Institute of Industrial Technology presented their android during an exhibition at the Seoul Education Culture Center. Eve R-1, a name that combines Eve and robot, looks like a Korean female in her early 20s, the Times reported, noting that from a distance the android might be mistaken for a real person. Senior Institute scientist Baek Moonhong says that Eve R-1 amply demonstrates South Korean robotic technologies are at the forefront of the world. For now, Eve R-1 can be employed as a guide robot at museums and department stores or as an educational model to read books to children. So, there you go. It's probably quite a few people's idea of paradise, a female android. But I don't know if I would be too happy to be greeted by an android at my next visit to the museum. And from the rapidly developing world of robotics to the equally rapidly expanding nanotech industry, here's a story from the BBC News Science and Technology Department. Toxic warnings for the nano industry. We see these labels everywhere now. Especially if you're female, you'll have noticed on your moisturizers, on some of your cosmetics, this new sticker on the label which says contains nanoparticles. Well, are nanoparticles something that we really should be worried a bit more about? The Royal Society of the UK has said that maybe we should be. They say public information is needed because of uncertainties over the safety of some products that contained particles engineered at small scales. A new inventory of consumer goods lists over 200 items that are already available and contain nanotechnology. The Royal Society and the Royal Academy of Engineering published a report that urged tighter controls in Europe and the UK on some aspects of the industry. In particular, it highlighted the potential risk of free nanoparticles that might escape to the atmosphere and have an effect on health. The production of nanoparticles is just one branch of nanotechnology that involves the manipulation of molecules and even atoms to make new materials. Manufactured nanoparticles are dust-like fragments with diameters of less than 100 nanometers, or billionths of a meter, or 1,000th the width of a human hair. Nanoparticles made from metals, alloys and ceramics are already used in many products, including sunscreens, paints and sticking plasters or band-aids. A new web inventory of consumer products lists 231 products that purport to contain nanotechnology, showing how the tiny science is increasingly becoming an everyday part of our lives. Most nanotechnology poses no known risk to humans, but some researchers question whether nanoparticles may be different because they are known to be able to cross over into the areas of the body that larger particulates, which humans are exposed to every day, cannot reach. This is one area where there is some uncertainty about safety, said Professor Anne Dowling, chair of the report. The Royal Society statement was made in the same week that a leading UK researcher said that there had been a failure to act on the recommendations of the Royal Society's report. So basically what this story is saying is if you see something that says it's got nanoparticles in it, the best thing is probably to steer clear of it, because you just don't know what some of the consequences might be. Something, however, that we have got a lot more control over is our memory and how well we retain it as we move into old age. And one of the best reports that I've seen lately is about green tea. And we know that it is often drunk for its positive health benefits. And researchers, again in the UK at Newcastle University, found that green tea inhibited the activity of key enzymes in the brain associated with memory, and they believe their findings, published in Phytotherapy Research, could herald the development of a new treatment for Alzheimer's disease. The team from the university's Medicinal Plant Research Centre investigated the properties of coffee, green tea and black tea in a series of scientific experiments. They found that both green and black tea inhibited the activity of enzymes associated with the development of Alzheimer's, but coffee had no significant effect. And how much green tea a day do you need? Well, it's been determined that all you need are just 2 cups a day. And that's it for the news this week. Coming up after the break, we'll be introducing our very special guest, Melon Thomas Benedict. You're listening to Otherwhere, and I'm Liz Miller. And after this break, we might just find out that life really does go on and on.
Thank you.
you've just joined us, you're listening to Otherwhere. What can dying teach us about the human potential? Is it possible that there is no death and only entrance into fuller life? When I was first doing research for the show, I was led to my bookshelf and a book that I haven't picked up for quite some time sort of leapt out at me. It's a book published by the Lucis Trust, the foundation set up by Alice A. Bailey, who, along with the Ascended Master Dwal Kul, wrote around 35 very long discourses on esoteric subjects, and this one is called A Treatise on White Magic. And I'd like to read out a couple of sections because I thought they were very pertinent to this week's program. As time progresses and before the close of the next century, death will be finally seen to be non-existent in the sense in which it is now understood. Continuity of consciousness will be so widely developed, and so many of the highest types of men will function simultaneously in the two worlds, that the old fear will go, and the intercourse between the astral plane and the physical plane will be so firmly established and so scientifically controlled that the work of the transmediums will rightly and mercifully come to an end. People are apt to forget that every night, in the hours of sleep, we die to the physical plane and are alive and functioning elsewhere. They forget that they have already achieved facility in leaving the physical body, because they cannot as yet bring back into the physical brain consciousness the recollection of that passing out and of the subsequent interval of active living. They fail to relate death and sleep. Death, after all, is only a longer interval in the life of physical plane functioning. One has only gone abroad for a longer period, but the process of daily sleep and the process of occasional dying are identical, with the one difference that in sleep the magnetic thread or current of energy along which the life force streams is preserved intact and constitutes the path of return to the body. In death, this life thread is broken or snapped. When this has happened, the conscious entity cannot return to the dense physical body, and that body, lacking the principle of coherence, then disintegrates. And that, as we all know, is what happens to the body. But what about the indwelling spirit within? The late Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, author of On Death and Dying, still considered to be the seminal Western text on the subject, once said, "When we have passed the tests we are sent to Earth to learn, we are allowed to graduate. We are allowed to shed our body, which imprisons our souls." Death is simply a shedding of the physical body, like the butterfly shedding its cocoon. It is a transition to a higher state of consciousness, where you continue to perceive, to understand, to laugh, and to be able to grow. For those who seek to understand it, death is a highly creative force. The highest spiritual values of life can originate from the thought and study of death. So with that said, I'd like to introduce Melon Thomas Benedict to the show. And I do hope that before this broadcast you have had a chance to take a look at his story, Journey to the Light and Back, which is available at several different websites, but the one to get it from is melonthomas.com, and that's melon, M-E-L-L-E-N hyphen thomas.com. If you haven't had a chance to check out his story, I'd like to briefly fill you in a little bit now. Melon Thomas Benedict's story has been well documented, and you can find it in many books that discuss the near-death experience. After suffering from a terminal illness in 1982, Melon Thomas died, and for an hour and a half he was monitored, showing no vital signs. Miraculously, he returned to his body with a complete remission of the disease and one of the most inspirational near-death experiences known to date. While on the other side, Melon journeyed through several realms of consciousness and beyond the light at the end of the tunnel that is reported by so many who've had the NDE experience. He was shown during his near-death experience in holographic detail Earth's past and a beautiful vision of mankind's future for the next 400 years. He experienced the cosmology of our soul's connection to Mother Earth, our role in the universe, and was gifted with access to universal intelligence. Since his near-death experience, Mellon Thomas has maintained his direct access to universal intelligence and returns to the light at will, enabling him to be a bridge between science and spirit, and fulfilling, really, our mission here on Earth. He has been involved in research programs on near-death experiences and has developed new technologies for health and wellness. With humility, insight, and depth of feeling, he will share with us his experience and insights. He brings back from his near-death experience a message of hope and inspiration for humanity, delivered with a joy and clarity that is refreshing. His depth of feeling and passion for life is a gift to be shared, and so it is with great pleasure that I can welcome Mellon Thomas Benedict to the airwaves of Otherwhere and bbsradio.com.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, we've got so much to talk about. You've had an incredible life and some incredible experiences during your life. Of course, the one that everyone knows about is the fact that in 1982 you died for over an hour and a half. And you retained full consciousness of what actually happened to you on the other side, which I know is incredibly rare, because the type of information that you brought back was very, very different to the types of experiences people usually relate when they talk about a near-death experience. I know that you had some experience before you crossed over in the hospice of having out-of-body experiences before that. And as you describe going into the death experience, I believe that there was a feeling that you had of being paralyzed.
I suddenly was outside of my body, looking at my body in the bed. And light was like leaving my body, and the thought occurred to me, because I'd been in hospice preparing to die, that maybe I was dead now. And it was a very lonely feeling, very, very lonely. And I was watching this light leave my body, which I thoroughly understand now, even the quantum physics of it, but then it was a very, very lonely feeling, and that loneliness surrounded me, and that may be what you could interpret as a being paralyzed. And the loneliness and the being cut off, and then almost immediately a life review began. And it began from that moment and ticked all the way back until I was in my mother's womb. And I got to see every minute of my life, how I had been affected by my life, and how I had affected other people with my life. Not only other people, but other things, dogs and cats and trees and things like that. All vividly, it was like a holographic movie happening simultaneously all around me. And my life's issues were what was paralyzing me, because I had never been trained or enlightened into dealing or processing your issues, and there I was in the middle of my issues, and my issues were what was trapping me and also making me feel very cut off from all the rest of the world, as it were. And that was almost a hellish experience, that loneliness, that being cut off. And it seemed to almost last forever. It seemed like an eternity. I know it was just probably a very short period, but I had a complete life review, and suddenly I understood my life. Not that I liked a lot of it, not that it was pleasant, and not that it was, you know, all sweet, and in fact, very little sweetness, but I finally understood why I had turned out the way I turned out, and all the reasons and pressures and events that had made me what I was. But that wasn't very comforting in the end, the understanding of it all. And I saw my parents' issues, and I'm someone who thought my parents never loved me, and I saw that in their own way they had really, really loved me, especially my mother, but because of their life could not really show it. And I think a lot of people have experienced this, not being close to your parents. In fact, maybe most people. I also saw when I was in my mother's womb that I was conscious, and I believe fetuses are conscious. I believe everything is conscious. And I saw things while I was in my mother's womb that I reported to my mother later after my near-death experience that she said was impossible for me to know about, but I knew every detail, and it shocked her and surprised her.
It's actually something that I've heard from people who are parents to indigo children. A lot of those children, upon learning how to speak for the very first time, some of their very first sentences are about what they heard or felt in the womb. So you're absolutely onto it there. That's very true.
Yeah, and I saw that my issues actually began in the womb. My main issues of my life began in the womb, created by my mother and father, basically. They weren't getting along well, and my father was an alcoholic, and would be a mean alcoholic when he was drunk, and he would beat my mother. And as a fetus inside of her, I relived her being beaten, and the sound of him hitting her was like thunder, and all of her hormones, all of her fear, all of her emotions were racing through me. And how it affected me was, and I saw this clearly, was these kind of things affect people in different ways. But in my case, I got really angry. I got very, very angry in the womb. And by the time I was born, I already was programmed to think that the world was a dangerous place and that males were very dangerous beings. And that's why I was never close to my father ever in my life. I could never get close to him, and I only understood that in my near-death experience. But every time he hit her, I felt everything she felt amplified. And I pretty much realized I was born angry, and I lived angry. And my anger turned into wanting to, you know, be an ecologist. My anger turned into trying to do something about the injustices in the world. And so I became an early ecologist, and I was always interested in those sort of things. And then as a teenager, the hippie movement of the 60s hit, and I hit it just right. I became a long-haired hippie, and, of course, all the movements and all the activity of the 60s gave you a lot to take a stand on. And this is how my anger transformed me. But at the base of it all, at the base of my being, I was an angry being. And I began to believe, being sort of an information person, listening to all the experts in my childhood and in my teenage years, listening to all the experts saying that mankind had gone wrong, the end of the world was near, all the, you know, end of the world crowd, and ecologists were saying even if we stopped now, and this was back in the 60s, even if humanity stopped what it was doing now, it was too late to save the planet. And then you had the Cold War, and a lot of young people don't even realize what the Cold War was like. And only 9/11 has given even a taste of what it was like to be raised in the peak of the Cold War, when you envied your neighbors who built bomb shelters, little caves in their yards to go into. And I began, probably when I was a teenager, I began to think that nature had gone wrong. And I had no spiritual background, per se, because, and forgive me for saying this, but I'd been raised partly in Catholic boarding school. And I believe those kind of schools are turning out a lot of atheists. You live that experience, you just don't believe there is a God. But at the same time, we were always told we were going to go to hell for eternity. So as a young person, you contemplate some of the deepest mysteries. So I happen to think for that. You know, you contemplate going to hell for eternity. What is that? I contemplated that so many nights alone in my bed in the dormitory. And so by the time I was in my early 20s, I saw an ecology photograph, and I know these people meant well, but I don't think they also understand how they damaged people with these images. They meant well, I'm sure. But a big ecology group put out a series of photographs, and it was a photograph of Los Angeles from the air compared to a blow-up of a cancer cell. And they look exactly the same.
I've seen that photo.
And they say, you know, some people say it's a straw that broke the camel's back. In my case, it was a photograph. From that moment on, it clicked in my mind that nature had gone wrong and created a cancer named humanity. And humanity was actually a cancer on the planet. And guess what I developed years later? I developed terminal brain cancer. And so that goes to show you your belief systems and your self-fulfilling prophecies will always come back on you. So it's very, very important what you believe and what you project on other people. Because I was a great bubble popper in those days. I was telling people, it's over. You know, I can prove the world is over. It's all done. And I was wrong. I was very wrong. And my near-death experience gave me the perspective to see past all of that. So, you know.
Dr. Kenneth Ring, author of Heading Towards Omega, The Omega Project, says, Mellon Thomas has the big picture. His story is one of the most remarkable I've ever encountered in extensive research on near-death experiences. It is very rare that those who have died and returned have seen into the future to the extent that Mellon has, and his vision of the future is one of hope. And that's pretty much what you were just saying. Would you expand on that, please?
On the hope?
Yeah, on your vision of the future as a hopeful one.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that, and I really didn't know about, I'd never really heard the word near-death or even hospice or even the word metaphysics was not in my vocabulary before I had my near-death experience. In fact, having been raised in a Catholic boarding school, I was beyond atheist. I was not interested in religion or spirituality at all. It was completely boring. So I basically didn't have much of a background on that until after my near-death experience. And one of the things that I got to learn afterwards by people like Phyllis Atwater, P.M.H. Atwater, who's a prolific writer in the field, who actually discovered me in the backwaters and introduced me to Ken Ring. Ken Ring was very helpful and very influential in my life, and he came to my little hometown in the Deep South and came to visit me, the great man, and we became friends, and still are. And I was really surprised to find out certain things that I thought was normal. One of which is when I went up to the light, I finally got past my issues and went to the light. I had this notion to ask the light if it would stop a minute and talk with me, and it did. And that notion gave me the idea that just as life is interactive, our death experience is completely and totally interactive.
Would you please tell the audience at what point you decided to ask the light to communicate with you?
Right when I was taken to the light. Of course, and I wasn't even an atheist, but I was drawn to the light, up to the light, and I was standing in this light that's unimaginable, unexplainable. And like no other love you've ever experienced beyond anything you can experience, and it was transforming. Right at that moment, the light started to change, and I asked it to hold on a minute because I didn't know what was going to happen next. And from what researchers say is I'm the first person that they have ever recorded that actually did that. That changed the experience consciously while I was there. And to my amazement, the light totally said yes. Where do you want to go now? And I just said, I have a lot of questions before I go. And I was allowed to ask every question I ever had in my life. It was fascinating. I asked every question I'd ever had and about so many subjects, and the questions were answered to my satisfaction. And there came a moment in which I realized I had no more questions. And I live a life now of no questions, I only have answers. But when I say that, I want people to understand that although all of my personal questions have been answered to my satisfaction, every single one of us has a unique set of questions for the universe. So I don't know everything at all. I don't claim to know everything. I just know that my questions about the universe have been answered to my satisfaction, to my understanding on many levels. And interesting thing that happened at that moment was I ran out of questions, and the light asked me, "But what was your first question?" And I thought for a second, first question. And then it dawned on me that I had the first major question I ever remember asking, and I asked it until I was a teenager, hit puberty, and got interested in women, and you know, left high school, and never thought about it again until the day I died. But I had a question when I was a child, from my earliest age, that I bugged everybody. I bugged the nuns, I bugged doctors, I bugged my parents, I bugged everybody with this question, and that was, why do we grow old and die? That was my first question I ever had. Probably thanks to being in boarding school and having to contemplate eternity quite often. And to my amazement, the light responded, and two columns of light came out of the light itself. And on the right side of this column of light, a little Indian man stepped out, looked like he was from India. And I saw or was made aware of the word Dinshaw. And this turned out to be a historical figure, because I spent years tracing and tracking everything I'd learned on the other side. This was Darius Dinshaw, who was an Indian man who was a leader, pioneer in photo and color therapy. And he had actually lived in New Jersey, in the States. And he had been persecuted in the 30s and 40s and pretty much run out of business. But he stepped out of this light and started educating me on wavelengths and color and how light heals and how light regenerates. And then, out of the left-hand column of light, a short, portly man appeared. And he had a beret on and a funny mustache. And this turned out to be a man named Walter Russell. And Walter Russell, it turns out to be a historical character, who started the University of Light in Charlottesville, Virginia. And he was a real Renaissance man. He was a master of studying of light and stardust and starlight. And of course, now we know that everything that we are in the physical universe is made of stardust.
That's right.
We are stardust that has come into consciousness. And he educated me about starlight and the electrons. I mean, he got very technical about electrons being the essence of life, and every living thing lives on electrons. And so I was educated and given frequencies and given wavelengths and all of this indelible in my mind. And my question was answered. It's the truth is that we only grow old and die because we're ignorant of how not to at this point. It turns out, as I was taught on the other side, that this body you're in right now, if you look at your hand, you look at that hand, this body you're in right this moment has already been alive forever. You don't come from anything dead. You come from life, and life that has transformed itself through every known substance and vibration in the universe to get here. And so we have already been alive forever, and we will never, ever experience death. We will only experience waking up. We will be waking up forever.
otherwhere.
Would you mind telling me how Kenneth Ring has helped you in your life since you met him?
Yes, I met Kenneth through PMH Atwater, Phyllis Atwater, who's a great writer, and he took an interest in my case because there were a couple of unique things that I didn't know about with my my particular experience, one of which is that I became aware that death was an interactive experience, just as life is here, an interactive experience. And I encourage people to realize that if you have a near-death experience, it is a interactive experience. It's not just a roller coaster ride you get on and take a ride that's out of your control. You are completely in control of your own death experience, and try to remember that if that ever happens to you. It becomes more fascinating. The other thing that I realized was that we should process our life issues in life and not wait till we die to process. It's much, much better to process in the moment all of your life's issues and stay clear as you move through life. The other thing that Ken pointed out to me that I thought was normal among near-deathers is that I return to the light every day and always have. Every day. I return to the light. And when it first started happening, after my near-death experience, it's like an out-of-body experience. I thought I was dying. It was actually a scary experience. And I resisted it, but it kept happening. But every time the light pulled me out of my body, and we would have these great conversations, and I had asked the light if there was anything I could bring back to the physical world that would help, because I wanted to be a nuts and bolts guy. I'm not really a philosopher, and I don't know how helpful philosophy really has been on the planet, but I wanted to be able to bring back something tangible, something useful, something helpful in a physical nuts and bolts kind of way, and that has been my focus and my mission ever since. And Kenneth explained to me that I'm the only near-deather he knows that does that. I was surprised. I thought they all went back to the light whenever they wanted to. And it turns out that most near-deathers spend the rest of their lives trying to go back to the light through various modalities. And but every time I go to the light, information is transferred to me that is helpful and useful, and sometimes very humorous, because the universe actually has a great sense of humor. It really does, although sometimes it's hard to see it here on the planet. In fact, I was told, you know why Earth is one of the favorite places to reincarnate?
Why is that?
This is where you come when you need to rest from eternal bliss. So don't expect to get it here. This is where you get a vacation from eternal bliss. That may help some people.
I'm sure it will. And that's, I'm going to have to ask you a little bit more about that a bit later on in the interview as well. But please continue.
And it was that information that Kenneth and I sort of tripped on, is this ability to go back to the light and get inventions. And it's through Kenneth Ring that I was introduced to other researchers and ended up being a part of other research projects for many years after that, thanks to Kenneth Ring. And I've done some very notable work at some universities. I've done work decoding genetic diseases and inventions, projects, energy medicine. And the interesting thing about the process was is that in working with scientists and doctors and researchers, we soon discovered that the most important part of retrieving the proper information was having the proper question. If you don't have the proper question, you're never going to get the proper answer. And so that became a skill that we developed, is how to sit the question and ask the proper question to get the exact and specific information that you're looking for, not just philosophy, but real information that you can build things with, test things, use them. I became sort of a favorite guinea pig for years until about 1995, when I stopped doing that the way I used to. But in the old days, you'd send me a plane ticket and I'd go anywhere to work on an experiment with you.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program. and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.